first of all, let me start with a quotation from the Buddha. It goes something like this. In one who investigates what is arising and embarks upon a full investigation of it, tireless energy is aroused. On that occasion, the energy enlightenment factor, when the awareness awakening factor, is aroused. And by developing it, one brings it to fulfillment. So energy, or virya, you know, that's the Sanskrit term, or Pali term rather, and you can see the root in terms of the similar to virility, you know, virility, virya, is that quality or factor which is the root of all achievement, in direct opposition to sloth and torpor or laziness. So we need energy to do anything. So the thing is to understand, but energy is also known as a variable factor because it can be associated with wholesome or unwholesome states. So the whole question is how to understand energy in terms of its wholesome applications, you know, to the meditative process. Different words or nuances of the word are effort, courage, vigor, perseverance, persistence, and all point to different facets, you know, of this quality of mind. The basic meaning is the energy to do things. And the meaning in the Pali is shoring up. Energy is what shores up effort. So as we do effort, the energy gives power to the effort. So the energy enables effort to occur. So this is an important relationship to understand. In order to do anything, you have to have energy, you know, to do whatever we're doing. So effort is supported by energy. Another nuance is the quality or aspect of strength. And the quotation goes, here the noble disciple dwells as one who has produced strength for the sake of abandoning unskillful dhammas or unskillful thoughts and actions and arousing skillful ones. One is firm of steady valor, unrelinquishing of purpose with regard to skillful dharmas. So here, of course, the Buddha is highlighting the critical importance of virya as a power or force in the mind, and also the importance of putting it to wise use for skillful purposes. Now, another quality of energy that is very, very powerful, and to me, in my mind, in the practice, is one of the most important aspects of energy, is the quality of courage. It's the quality of strength of heart, the opposite of laziness and sloth and torpor. It's energized by difficulties and challenges. It's the quality that reaches out in the face of difficulty and is not discouraged by difficulties or obstacles. Now, one aspect of this definition of courage that, for me personally, as well as for the people that I've worked with in this practice, is that aspect of the courage to face our afflictive emotions. When anger, rage, guilt, embarrassment, envy, jealousy, you know, the kinds of emotions that we may not, you know, sort of necessarily openly, you know, sort of admit to or like to admit to ourselves. When these kinds of feelings come up, we all have these feelings. I mean, there's no one who doesn't have these kinds of feelings in whatever sphere of life that might be important to you. You know, there might be a competitor, there might be a person who's better at it than you are or worse at it than you are. You know, these kinds of feelings of envy, jealousy, you know, disliking, you know, sort of hostility arise. So it takes a great deal of courage and honesty to acknowledge, you know, the presence of these kinds of feelings and emotions. And I think one of the largest, the largest barriers, the most powerful barriers to self-awareness and self-awakening is our reluctance to acknowledge the feelings that we might be having. And as Kabat-Zinn says, you know, in his essay, what keeps us from not judging, not closing doors, and, you know, is fear. You know, fear of our inadequacy, fear of what we're feeling might begin to start to tell us about ourselves. You see, and this is really, it can be the fatal stopping point of any practice, because people can go up to this point and they start encountering these feelings or these kinds of emotions and they just can't go any further. They just stop and they say, oh, this is great, you know, I feel very relaxed, very still, very quiet. But when it comes to going deeper and acknowledging feelings that may be unpleasant, may be difficult to accept, you know, that's where the practice stops. Because people just don't want to open those doors. And so, and this, I encounter this very frequently in people who, you know, as their practice deepens, they start running up against this stuff. And it becomes an obstacle for them. So courage is a huge, huge aspect. It's really a form of, you know, I don't know how many people in this room have seen a therapist, you know, a counselor or a psychotherapist or a psychologist or a psychiatrist. You know, when you make a commitment to see a professional therapist, you have to say to yourself, I'm not going to hide anything. When I sit and talk to my counselor, I have to tell my, you know, I have to tell my counselor everything that's on my mind. Because if I didn't tell, you know, if I only told selected aspects of my experience, you know, it's just a waste of money. You know, you're not going to receive any kind of therapy. You're not going to receive any kind of feedback that's relevant to the truth of what is happening to you. And meditation is exactly the same. As a matter of fact, it's even more difficult because you're dealing with yourself. You're not having to deal with someone else who you can easily fool or give a half-truth or, you know, say, you know, give only parts of your experience and hide the other parts. But you can't hide it from yourself. So that's where this quality of courage, to me, is really, really one of the most important factors, you know, in this whole aspect of bringing energy to our practice. Okay, another aspect which is very important is when energy can be productive and when it can be counterproductive. When energy is balanced, how can we remain balanced, you know, in the meditative process? When effort is, or energy is unskillful, there is a forcing of the mind. You know, there's like this really kind of, you're pushing it too hard. Or it's called efforting. It's like a verb, you know, where you're putting too much effort. When we try to make something happen, you know, we're trying to attain a certain, you know, state of mind, or we're trying, you know, we're pushing, and we build up these expectations that I ought to be this way or I ought to be that way. You know, if I do this correctly, if I follow the instructions, if I do it correctly, you know, I should be in samadhi. And so there's this expectation that drives the practice, and you push and push and push. There's a sense of agenda. Now, this is where an energy can be unskillful and counterproductive, because your mind just simply gets caught up in an objective effort to achieve something rather than simply relaxing into the moment. So when this mind is tense and full of expectations, rather than being open and flexible, that is when, you know, the practice, you know, can fall apart. You can become agitated, you can become restless, and you know, the energy sort of goes in the wrong way. It's a misperceived sense of energy. So the whole point of the process is to bring effort into the practice, but once we come into the meditative state, to be in a very balanced and sort of relaxed and open sort of state of mind, and to just simply maintain that balance and not, you know, not judge yourself, not, you know, not create expectations about how you should be or could be or ought to be, you know, but simply be in the moment, you know, be with the breath, be in the silence. So letting go of expectations, letting go of results, you know, that you think you ought to be achieving as you do the practice. It's just basically learning how to ease in, relax, but bringing the effort to do come to that point, but not pushing it, you know, overly pushing it, so it becomes, you know, sort of counterproductive. Now, there's a very sort of appropriate kind of quotation by a teacher by the name of Sayadaw Utejaniya, and he's a Burmese Sayadaw, and he was quoted as saying this: one thing you need to remember is that you cannot leave the mind alone. It needs to be watched constantly. If you do not look after your garden, it will overgrow with weeds. If you do not watch your mind, defilements will grow and multiply. The mind does not belong to you, but you are responsible for it. So the mind, you know, has a mind of its own, as we all know, right? We don't really control our minds. So the only way we can really sort of be responsible is to be aware, to be mindful, to sort of learn to manage, you know, our impulses, you know, our craving, our attachments, our aversions, our conditioned impulses, you know, toward the world and toward things and toward ourselves. So the mindfulness is this capacity to tend the garden, as it were, so that it doesn't become overgrown with weeds and become of a briar patch, you know, sort of like in the case of the tar baby in the briar patch. We don't want it to become a briar patch, but we want it to be a well-cultivated garden. But probably the most fundamental question in terms of this whole discussion of energy is, what causes energy to arise? And what is the motivation that leads us, that stimulates us to commit ourselves to the practice, to do the work, to come to sittings every week and, you know, have a daily, you know, practice at home, and to read books and study the Dharma and make the effort, you know, to expand our knowledge and experience, you know, in this whole practice. And that quality is called, you know, spiritual urgency. Spiritual urgency. We all experience and we all feel a certain quality of spiritual urgency, right? There's some urgency that motivates us to think about these questions. What motivates you to even come here, to sit here on a Saturday afternoon, you know, listening to this guy spouting off about some, some godforsaken ideology about something, to sit on a cushion, to come into silence, you know, to study, you know, Buddhist or the Dharma teachings? What is it that motivates you? What caused you to do this? Now, of course, every one of us has our own reasons. You know, it could be some illness, some great tragedy that happened to us or to, you know, a relative or a friend. Or, you know, basic questioning, you know, of the meaning of life. You know, what is my purpose? Or a sense of angst, sort of anxiety about who we are in this world. Or just a questioning of, you know, the whole direction of culture and civilization in the world today. So we all have our reasons, you know, for coming to do this practice, to extending our awareness into this whole sort of alternative view of the world. I mean, it is an alternative view of the world compared to, you know, classic Western Judeo-Christianic philosophy and ideology. So in other words, we're, you know, within this cultural context, we are the, you know, the Christians in the catacombs. You know, we are the people who are questioning the overall prevailing, you know, religious and cultural political ideology, looking for an alternative worldview. So we do it for a personal, deep personal reason. And every one of us, you know, has this reason for being here today and for doing this practice. So in relationship to that, there are a list of what are called basic reflections. And these are drawn from the classical teachings, and they reflect classical Buddhist view of the world. And so I want to run through these today and sort of give you a feeling of how this is taught, you know, in the Buddhist world, in terms of why it is that we are so privileged and so gifted, you know, to be able to do this practice, you know, the way that we're able to do it today. Well, first of all, let me just say, just off the cuff, that I think we are just, you know, incredibly, incredibly lucky to have access to this teaching, you know, this wisdom, this teaching that was formulated. Now it's estimated about 2,800 years ago, not 2,500 years ago. This recent archaeological findings about, you know, the actual birthplace of the Buddha is estimated to predate the existing estimation by about 300 years. So almost 3,000 years ago, this is an ancient teaching that comes from almost 3,000 years ago. To have access to that teaching in almost as clear and lucid and genuine, assuming, of course, that it's genuine in terms of the Theravadin teachings, the actual Theravadin teachings, today in the 21st century, to benefit from that transmission of knowledge that has come through literally almost 3,000 years today, and to see a resurgence of the teaching in modern Western society, not to mention, you know, in Asia. Actually, in Asia, it's practically, you know, in decline because of, you know, modernization, industrialization, you know, in Asia. But to be the recipients, you know, the people benefiting from the resurgence of this teaching and this practice in this modern age is an incredible, incredible gift. So anyway, the factors that are listed are, and of course, I think all of us are affected to this in some fashion, more or less in some fashion, is the reflection. These are reflections. So reflecting on the suffering in our lives, the suffering that we experience in our lives, seeing our emotional and physical pain in our lives and in the lives of those around us, trying to understand the meaning and purpose, you know, of this suffering, of the pain, of the setbacks and obstacles that we experience in life, our emotional afflictive, you know, our afflictive emotions, our pain, our suffering. What is the meaning of all this? Why are we going through all of this? You know, is there a meaning? Is there some silver lining to this dark cloud of suffering that we experience in our lives? And I think there isn't anyone in this room who doesn't understand that we suffer. We suffer in many and diverse ways, in a very subtle ways and in very gross and, you know, very obvious ways. And it's physical suffering in terms of, you know, sickness, illness, disease, emotional suffering in terms of stress, anxiety, anger, rage, all the kinds of emotional pain that we experience. So what is this? Right? What is this suffering? What is this stuff that I go through in my life? Is it, you know, is this all there is? You know, if there is, I might as well just commit suicide. I mean, why should I even hang around? You know, what is the meaning of all this? Is there a meaning? If one thinks about this in any, you know, sort of meaningful, deep, reflective way, you know, that becomes a real motivation to begin to try to find some answers, right? So the process of seeking, the process of, you know, sort of the journey begins, because as an effort, you know, to understand why or what the purpose of the suffering that we experience is, you know, in our lives. A second reflection is the reflection on the preciousness and rarity of our present circumstances. What it means is, how rare is it for the conditions to come together for us to practice? Conditions are so uncertain, so to have the opportunity to practice arouses a special sense of spiritual urgency. Now, what this means is, what is it in your life that somehow attracted you to this practice? I mean, there are a lot of people who have a sense of spiritual urgency, you know, but they become Catholics, or they become Protestants, or they, you know, they become, you know, Sufi practitioners, or they practice yoga, you know. So a lot of people have, you know, this question in their mind about, you know, spiritual meaning, spiritual awareness and spiritual wisdom. But what is it that brought you to this practice? The Buddhist practice, and specifically the Theravadan Buddhist practice, as opposed to, say, Zen or Tibetan Buddhist, the practice of mindfulness, you know, in the tradition of, you know, the Theravadan lineage, which is basically said to be the original practice that was developed by the Buddha himself. So this practice was developed 2800 BC. It far precedes the evolution of Mahayana, Zen practice, Tibetan Buddhist practice by thousands of years. So this is actually the, you know, the root practice in the Buddhist tradition. So to come to this practice, as opposed to Zen or Tibetan or other Buddhist practice, not to gainsay their importance, but from a historical perspective and from the kinds of the emphasis and the way the practice is taught and practiced itself, this is, you know, sort of distinctive. It has a distinctive quality to it, which is very different from the other practices. So for you to come, to somehow come here, to hear this practice, this lineage, taught in the way it's taught, is a very special thing. It's like somehow you came here. You didn't go to a Catholic church or, you know, a synagogue. You came here. So what is it about your karma allowed your radar, you know, to sort of make the decisions that it did to come here to do this practice, to study the Dharma, to, you know, to open to the Buddha's teaching? So that's a very special thing. It's almost precious. It is precious. What makes this practice, you know, mindfulness or Vipassana practice kind of unique, I think, is that it's the most psychological of the practices, because it's directly aimed at seeing, you know, and working with what arises within ourselves. So the whole aspect of concentration, rapture, bliss, you know, the concentration practices, I mean, they're acknowledged, but they're only used as a supportive element to the mindfulness practice. Whereas in other practices, those aspects of the practice are much more given much more predominance, mostly in the Hindu practices. And the Mahayana practices, there's a tendency to be more emphasized, the more emphasis going toward the concentration practices. So, and that's a result of the influence of Hinduism on Buddhism after the time of the Buddha's death. So that particular mix of influences, you know, kind of took the evolution of Buddhism in a slightly different direction. The Buddha's original practice was much more psychoanalytical, if you will, to use that term, in the sense that it was much more focused on our defilements, our suffering. And the whole original definition of Buddhism was freedom from defilements, freedom from suffering. So it's a much more consciously focused practice that is, you know, designed to look at, you know, our emotional states, our afflictive emotions. But yeah, this is really considered to be the original form of practice that the Buddha himself developed when he attained his awakening. So that's what drew me to it. Actually, I went through, I started in Tibetan, well, actually, I started in TM, you know. And then I went from TM to Tibetan Buddhist. And I actually studied with Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche in Boston for 2 years. And then I came back to Honolulu and I studied with Aiken Roshi Zen for about 3 or 4 years. But somehow I was just not quite, you know, it was happening, but, you know, somehow there was something missing. And then I discovered, you know, mindfulness, Vipassana. And that became my basic practice, you know, from about the middle 80s or so. So it was, for me, it was a search. It was a process of honing down onto, and it was basically moving back in historical time and finding the oldest form of practice. So this is really the oldest form of practice. And of course, it's the basis of mindfulness and, you know, everything that John Kabat-Zinn does. So, yeah. Okay, so the next reflection is reflection on death. Now, this is pretty, basic. Now, what is the relationship between death, life, and death? How do we accept death or the impermanence of life? How do we come to terms with it, with acceptance? And not aversion or fear or insecurity and denial, which is how we normally see death. I mean, we're usually in denial up to about the age of 70, I believe. And then finally, after about the age of 70, we kind of realize, well, I guess our life is not going to be permanent, And so there's this gradual sort of, awakening to the possibility that we may not live forever, But I think most of our lives, we think we're going to live forever. So this whole coming to terms with death is a big one in terms of motivating our practice, motivating our spiritual, deepening spiritual urgency. And I just have to tell you this story. I was in San Diego with my aunt, who was about to die. And she was in a hospice facility. And we were there, the whole family, her children and her grandchildren and myself from Honolulu. She was our San Diego aunt. And so it was just being with them through the last few days, of her life. And one night, we were sitting there, because we all knew it was going to happen within 1 or 2 days, because the nurses were telling us, the signs, they knew all the signs of what would happen as you approach, the final hours. So we all decided to stay in her room. So there were chairs and couches, so we're all kind of sleeping on the couches and playing cards and, kind of just hanging out. And I'll never forget this. This was about 3 in the morning, about 2:30 or 3 in the morning. And we're all kind of, just half asleep. And there was this blood-curdling scream from the next room. It was like, ah! I mean, literally at the top. It was like the whole building was almost... And it was just this blood-curdling scream. And we all jumped up. Everyone was, oh, what's going on? What's going on? And you could see the nurses running back and forth, and carts were being wheeled back, and people were just, all this commotion was going on in the hallway, and just this screaming and screaming. You could hear the door opening, and you could hear struggle going on in the next room. And we were just all like looking at each other, and what's going on? And this went on for about 10 minutes, and finally, it kind of subsided and died down, and so we all kind of, sort of went back to what we were doing. And the next morning, I came out and I asked one of the nurses, I said, well, what happened, 2:34 last night? And she said, well, she just had a freak out because she realized she was dying. And she just didn't want to die. And I was thinking to myself, oh my goodness. I mean, can you imagine, you're in a hospice and you know you're going to die, and to be consumed by that kind of fear, that would cause you to behave that way. I mean, it's just, this is beyond suffering. This is just, out of body, out of mind, out of everything. I mean, talk to me about not being in not being in contact with your own self. And that, to me, was just a powerful, powerful, lesson. Of course, my own aunt's passing away was powerful, but that, it taught me, talk about denial, talk about, sort of refusal to face reality, to that very, very end, to the point where just one completely has a complete emotional, physical breakdown. I mean, I can't think of a better definition of suffering than that. It was just amazing. So I just wanted to share that. I mean, I hope that none of us in this room ever approach our end of our lives, in that kind of a frame of mind. I mean, it would just be horrendous. The next reflection is a reflection on the fact that all our efforts at accumulation end in dispersion. All our efforts in accumulation, whatever it be, material wealth, power, influence, control, fame, glory, all ends in dispersion. It all, you know, melts away, ashes to ashes. So whatever we spend our time accumulating in our lives, like wealth and power and prestige and fame, and all of this, when we die, comes to nothing. Some people might, you know, they might build a presidential library for us, or they might, you know, they might write us in their history books. But that's about it. You know, we might have, you know, we might have been some guy who invented the computer or invented the internet, and some people might remember that Joe so-and-so did this and this. But basically, that's it. We're figments of memory. And we just go. There's nothing left. It just disperses out. So it's all, in a way, it's kind of, not to say that we shouldn't be creative, we shouldn't try to achieve things in the world, but we should understand that none of this is permanent. This all dissipates when we die. There's a famous saying by Shantideva, is that all that may be wished for, whatever it is, will by nature fade to nothing. All that may be wished for will by nature fade to nothing. The next reflection is also particularly powerful, and it's similar. The only abiding possession that we have, okay, when we reach the end of our lives, the only abiding possession that we have is the fruit of our actions. Basically, it's our karma. The fruit of our wholesome or unwholesome deeds. So if we lived a wholesome, you know, spiritually aware and wise and generous and compassionate life, you know, we will reap wholesome rewards, karmic rewards. And if it was the other way, we'll reap unwholesome karmic rewards. And those results will follow us into our next lifetime. So, you know, it doesn't end. You know, there's a cyclical pattern of karmic justice. You know, if it's good, it's good. If it's bad, it's bad. Whatever we reap, that is what we will sow. And that is all that is left for us when we die. Everything else is gone, but the only thing that remains is our karmic inheritance, which reflects the totality, you know, of the life that we lived. So this is pretty powerful motivation, you know, to sort of get our acts together in this life so that we don't end up, you know, inheriting all kinds of bad karma, you know, from all the nasty things we did in this lifetime. The next one, and this is a classic Buddhist reflection, that we have the great fortune of being on this great treasure island. It's called a treasure island. And this, what this means is this precious human birth that we have in this lifetime is precious and valuable because it's the only time that we have to understand and practice the causes of spiritual liberation and happiness. If we were reborn at the lower realms, in terms of the realms of animals and the, what is called petas, you know, the lower sort of realms, karmic realms, or even the higher deva realms that supersede or above the human realm, we go to those realms, but we don't exercise the capacity of choice. In other words, we can't change our karmic destiny when we're in those realms. The human realm is the only realm where we can actually change our karmic destiny. In other words, to attain liberation, to attain spiritual awakening and fulfillment, or if not having done that, to, you know, practice unwholesome, unskillful actions so that in our next life we're reborn at a lower level or reborn at the same level. Okay, so this is the only chance we have when we're human beings, you know, to actually change our karmic, you know, kind of fate. So to be born a human is a real privilege. it's a real special opportunity that we ought to be really thankful that we have. And yet, how many of us really appreciate the fact that we're actually human, that we're born, we're in this world, and we exercise the powers of conscious awareness that we do? Not many. This sense of gratitude for simply being alive. See, this is the whole point of these reflections, because it gets us down to a very basic level in terms of appreciating who we are, right? This life that we have, this is really the point of this whole teaching. It's like looking beyond all our expectations for, you know, money, sex, power, status, blah, blah, blah in the world, and just appreciating the fullness of the life that we have at that very fundamental, basic level. This is really what this teaching is all about, you know, expanding our hearts to appreciate just being alive. This is what it's all about. The last one is reflecting on the defects, quote-unquote, of samsara. You know, what are the defects of samsara, this round of birth and rebirth? So the perpetual wandering through the rounds of existence driven by our unwholesome karma. You know, this is what the eternal suffering from lifetime to lifetime to lifetime that we go through because of our unwholesome afflictive emotions, our greed, hatred, and delusion. So what frees us from this endless cycle of ignorance and craving is the heroic power of virya, effort, strength. The strength, power, energy to step out of the pattern of our conditioning and to be mindful of the flow of phenomena rather than being lost and carried away, you know, by greed, hatred, and delusion. To be mindful, to be aware, and to release the control that all of our afflictive emotions, all of our conditionings has over us, to find that freedom from suffering. And this is what frees us from this endless round of birth and rebirth and suffering that's represented by samsara. Okay, so this is the ultimate sort of promise of the practice, the freedom from this endless round of birth and rebirth. Now, I'd like to add one more, and this is my own sort of personal reflection. And I think it encapsulates, you know, the Buddhist perspective in terms of the appreciation of who we actually are. And that is the notion that who we are at this precise moment in time, you know, in our lives, is a miracle. Is a complete, complete miracle. Now, what I mean by that is that if you take the whole evolution of life, the whole evolution of the galaxy from the time of the Big Bang, 14 billion years ago, the dispersal of the chemical elements, carbon, hydrogen, you know, nitrogen, etc., oxygen, and the whole formation of planets, the whole formation of galaxies, and the whole formation of our universe, our particular galaxy, the Milky Way, the formation of our particular universe with our sun, with the planets, you know, and the gradual, you know, formation of the Earth and the Moon, and then the gradual evolution of life, you know, in terms of the combination of oxygen and hydrogen and water, and then the evolution of marine life, plant life through photosynthesis, and the coming together of all of the elements of evolution of life, and then the gradual evolution of that life through, you know, through the various Pleistocene, Cretaceous, blah blah blah, all these ages for 4 billion years, you know, up to, you know, dinosaurs and mammals, and then, you know, sort of Homo erectus and Neanderthal and, you know, all the various subspecies that gradually came together and blah, 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 all the way up to modern, you know, Homo erectus, the modern Homo sapien, to the point where we have evolved, you know, the brains, the consciousness, the awareness, the capacity to be who we are in this world in the moment. That is a miracle. It's an absolute absolute miracle. That this consciousness, this awareness, this beacon of awareness could exist in this remote corner of the universe on this little speck in the middle of the galaxy, right? Now, not to say that there might not be other areas where this little speck of awareness might have evolved, but in that sense, we're very, very, very special. You know, we're in a very, very local address in the far suburbs of the galaxy, far from where the Big Bang occurred, just way out in the middle of the, you know, the country somewhere, right? But there's this little speck of life. And here we are, this sort of biomorphic sort of accretion on this rock that's going around through space. And here we are thinking about, you know, being in the, you know, we are this process. We are the whole totality of this whole bioevolutionary process. And this consciousness that arises is the process. We are the Big Bang. We are this whole miraculous process of evolution, literally out of nothing, out of stardust. You know, this is what the scientists say. We are stardust. And it's absolutely true. We all decompose down into the basic elements. You know, hydrogen, you know, carbon, oxygen, etc. We're all carbon-based life forms. And it's all come together in a particular way so as to create who we are. And there's no, you know, in that sense, there's no me, there's no you, there's just this life process of which we are particular manifestations who happen to have consciousness. But somehow we've this consciousness has become sort of corrupted in a way so as to somehow believe that I'm a separate person, you're a separate person, the world is out there, I'm in here, somehow I'm not part of this process, somehow I am conditioned to have dominion over nature, over God's works, and so, you know, it's not as if I'm part of this process, somehow I'm separate from this process, somehow, you know, I'm entitled, you know, to control, to manage for my own purpose, for my own pleasure, for my own power, for my own desires. You know, somehow we've become sort of hypnotized by this kind of mythology of separation, of selfhood, right? Whereas in reality, we're nothing but this biomorphic accretion that has simply grown on the surface of this rock that's moving through space. It's called the earth is peopling. Like we are a verb, right? We are a process that has happened upon this earth that is, you know, this rock that's moving through space. Just like an ant, you know, is a member of this colony. There's no Joe, Harry, you know, Phyllis, and they're just ants. They're part of this larger reality. And they all have a role and a place. In the same way, we are the same. We are this biomorphic, you know, evolutionary miracle. And yet we suffer the delusion of separation, power, control. And of course there's a whole, you know, there's a whole explanation for how all of this evolved historically and what the cultural implications are. That's a whole other analysis. But the point is, if you accept the fact that this is the case, then there's nothing to be done except to have complete gratitude and sense of thankfulness for the very fact that we're here. And that, you know, that in fact we are one. You are me and I am you. There is no self and there is no other. We are all the same. We're all part of this whole process of, you know, the bioevolutionary, you know, process of this globe. So in that sense, you know, we're not separate, we're all part of this larger reality. And in an ultimate sense, this is what the definition of unconditional reality in the Buddhist context is. I mean, that's the irony. See, this is the irony. The whole evolutionary, from a scientific point of view, the whole evolutionary sort of story, you know, of the development of humankind actually coincides precisely with the Buddhist and the Hindu mythology. I say mythology in terms of the story, you know, of human evolution, you know, as opposed to the Judeo-Christianic tradition. Now, that's a whole other analysis, but the point is that when you come to this hall and you do this practice, you are coming into a whole different worldview. It's a different worldview. It's not the worldview of separate individual selves, you know, a consciousness that exists inside this skin that's separated from that consciousness, that's separated from God, that's separated from the universe, or separated from the earth and the planets and the animals. You know, it's a consciousness that says we're not separate. We're all part of the same process. We are the process. The process is us. So there's no separation between us and the plants and the animals and even the buildings and the, you know, the bench and the wood and everything that's around us. We are all part of this co-created universe. So if we understand that, and which I think is actually the truth, this is the truth of what the reality that we are is. This is the truth. So if we were to actually embrace that knowledge, embrace that understanding, embrace that wisdom, the whole way we see the world would be completely transformed. The whole way we see the world would be completely transformed. You know, it would not be a zero-sum world where what I give to you, you know, is at the cost of what I lose. You know, in other words, it's this balance between my welfare and your welfare. Me and you, self and other. The whole concept of self and other would not even exist. You know, our whole view of self, ego, you know, pleasure, pain, all of that would be completely transformed. We would see the world completely differently, with a completely open heart, with a completely sense of interconnectedness with all beings, with all plants, with all animals, with the earth. You know, we wouldn't be exploiting and destroying the earth the way we are doing, creating the kinds of climate change we see and the kinds of devastating, you know, weather phenomena that are going on in the world. We're destroying our whole planet because we have this mistaken view of who we are. And this is the ultimate consequence of this mythology, you know, of separateness. So that's why I think it's so important to really question that and to see ourselves in this new way, you know, that is being articulated through this teaching, and through that have a whole transformation of consciousness that would drive, I mean, talk about spiritual urgency, then it would really motivate our determination, you know, to free ourselves from the kind of suffering that we're just buried in, you know, all our lives. It's the suffering that comes from desire, wanting, and aversion, right? It's the suffering that comes from the sense of, I need to maximize my pleasure and my welfare in this world. It's the old Darwinian model. You know, as long as we subscribe to the Darwinian model, we're set up for suffering because it's all about what you get and what you don't get. You see what I'm saying? From other people and for myself. But if we look at it from the point of view of this co-creative, you know, evolutional, bioevolutionary process, there is no self, there is no other. We are all part of the same process. The whole definition of suffering, it wouldn't even have any meaning anymore, because there is no self to be aggrandized anymore. You know, our whole concept of other and self would be as if they were the same, they were identical. So there is no, we are all brothers and sisters in nature, in the whole process of evolutionary ascendancy, you know, to you. I mean, we rise through, you know, our spiritual evolution collectively as brothers and sisters together. And our hearts are open in compassion, in generosity. And it's not about me or you or my, you know, my welfare as opposed to yours anymore. So this is the whole paradigm shift, you know, that's implied by this way of thinking. So spiritual urgency is fundamentally based on how we see who we are in the world. And if we can come to this other understanding, it can drive our, talk about turbocharging our whole, you know, search for spiritual meaning. It would just completely turbocharge it and drive us to the point of awakening to a whole different view of reality. So, you know, I say this, I mean, because this is what I fundamentally believe, and this is, this is where I see the power of this teaching in terms of transforming our view of the world and our view of the self and our view of others. And that's fundamentally, I think, what the Buddhist teachings are all about in terms of, you know, conventional reality, absolute reality. I mean, I can go on forever and ever. But the point is, this is what it's actually saying. It's completely transforming our view of our relationship with ourself and with the world. And this is what it's all about. And if we start to have an inkling of this, if we start to see this, if we start to have a hint of where this is all going and what it means, it would really propel our practice in a way that we probably never would have, you know, experienced before. So thank you all very much. I mean, I really, I'm grateful for your attention and your time and your presence.